Well, I was wondering, I really didn't know what I was going to get up here tonight after the night. I've been sitting there since supper time, and it's been a rather eventful afternoon. Peg, last night, I felt so sorry for her. I started hyperventilating back there, and she was asking me, do I get nervous? I said, oh, no, and I really do. And I found out tonight I do, because after the meal tonight, I went on back to take a shower and get gussied up, you know, and took a shower and put on my T-shirt, and I sprayed real good, and I couldn't get my arms down, and hell, I'd sprayed myself with hairspray, and I had to get back in the shower and take another one, so I'm afraid to raise my arms too high. I might not be able to get them. One time out in Oklahoma, I was at a deal, and the same thing happened. I do get nervous, and after breakfast, I went on back to get ready for the Sunday morning meeting, and I was a Sunday morning speaker, and went in there to take a shower. And I was standing in the shower, and the thought come to me, damn, something's wrong, and it sure was. I had my pajamas on, and so I don't get nervous at all. And I really began to wonder if I was going to get up here, because I feel like I've been to a carnival tonight or something. I don't know. Playing bingo, or some numbers might come out, so don't be upset if I call out a few. It reminds me of a story that I've told many times about every time I talk, and it's true in this case. They tell me many years ago back in North Carolina, one of these conventions, I had a long-winded speaker, and he began to talk one night, and his first hour was on the 12 steps, and then he got into the second hour on the 12 traditions. Third hour, he got into the three legacies, and gradually people begin to leave, and they will leave. I found it out one night. And sure enough, everybody left, one man kept sitting on the front row. And so the speaker got concerned and wound up the talk, ran down from the podium, grabbed the man by the hand, said, I want to ask you one question. Everybody left but you, why'd you stay? And he said, hell, I'm the next speaker. Well, I kind of feel like that right now, if you know what I mean. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Dave Cook. Hi, everybody. By God's grace, and because this program works for me, and through the help of an understanding sponsor that I found with, that's laid me with a kind but firm hand, and through the love of a loving wife that I found as a result of this program, and through the help of many people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or any tablets since the day I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that day was September the 12th, 1957. I'm a member of the Big Book Group in Raleigh, North Carolina, which I think is the finest group in the whole wide world. And if you don't think the same about your home group, by God, you better find another one. Because I had a lot of problems with groups when I first got here. But the reason I give my sobriety date, I don't do it to impress you. Sometimes it impresses the hell out of me, I'll be honest. I give it for two reasons and two reasons only. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Roanoke, Virginia, the old Central Group. And the second meeting I ever went to was a discussion meeting. And I was no different from anybody else that goes to that first discussion meeting. I began to wonder what I was going to say when it got to me. And it finally got to me, and the man who was to become my first sponsor spoke up and told me what to say. He said, give your name and your sobriety date. That's all you're qualified to do. He explained to me after the meeting that's all I was going to be qualified to do for the next year. Was to give my name and sobriety date, and that was about the truth of it, too. And the second reason, they had a saying in that group that if you were a member of that group and you got behind the podium in that group and you didn't give your sobriety date, you usually didn't have one. So that's the reason I give my sobriety date. Before I begin, I'd like to say something, and I hope I don't get choked up. The first time I came here was 25 years ago. And I want to thank the Board of Trustees for asking me back again. I've been here several times, and I appreciate it. But in walking the halls and the, in the grounds today, there are some faces I don't see. And there are people that I have a lot of respect for in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the winners I call them. The people that were here that had it here for you and I. And I never want to forget those people. And some people in this room that are part of my sobriety, because I was 10 years sober when I came to Mount Eagle the first time, I believe. And I think of those people, and I don't know. When I think of those people, I think about the program and what it's done for me. And I don't want to ever take it for granted. The program has given me many benefits, such as what I call marginal benefits of peace of mind, happiness, security, and some serenity and material things. But any time I talk about marginal benefits, I have to talk about certain basics. And the basic benefit that I received in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, beyond my sobriety, and naturally sobriety came first, the basic benefit that I received is my sanity. And today, as a sane alcoholic, I find I don't have to run anymore. I don't have to cheat or steal anymore. I don't have to lie anymore. And most important of all, I don't have to sober up anymore. And I didn't know that's what it was all about when I got here. I don't have to sober up anymore. And I'm very grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't drink but for 13 years. And I came to AA when I was 29 years of age. And at that time now, you young people, I was a geek then. I mean, there was, back in the 50s, there was no such thing as young people coming in AA. And they looked at me kind of hard and asked me a lot of questions. And I told them how bad I hurt and where I hurt. And they said, son, you're in the right place. Sit down. And I've been here ever since. But I didn't take my first drink until I was 16, a freshman in college. For the life of me, I knew what drinking could do to a grown man, because I've seen what happened to my father. My daddy was an alcoholic. I know that today as a result of being in the program of AA. I didn't know it then. As a matter of fact, I didn't know anything about alcoholism until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I knew what a drunk was, but I didn't know what an alcoholic was. And I remember as a kid promising my mother I'd never be like him. And because of his drinking, and he was a good man. You've heard that. He's a good man as long as he doesn't drink. That was my daddy. And it led to a divorce in my home when I was 12 years of age. And my mother was able financially to clothe me and feed me and send me off to school and give me a good education. And I've looked back many times over the years. I had a problem comparing my drinking with my father's drinking, and the thing just about killed me, really. And so I had that background in drinking, and then when I went off to school, I was around a bunch of fellows that had just come back from World War II, knew how to drink. A lot older than I was, and I adjusted that environment. And I've always said, you know, there are different environments in sobriety. There are different environments when you drink, and different environments everywhere you go. And I adjusted that environment in drinking in college, and I began to do what the big boys were doing. I worked at it, got hard, you know, had trouble in the beginning getting it down, but you do it long enough and you'll finally get it down, struggle, cough, gasp, spit it up and all that stuff. And I've never forgotten a great lesson I learned. They used to talk about the pleasure that comes from drinking, and at that stage I was throwing it up most of the time, you know. So one night I asked one of the older fellows, says, when did the pleasure come that you speak of? He said, just remember, there's a pause in between from the time you take the drink and when you throw up. That's when the pleasure comes. Looking back now, I can see a little of that. But I went on. I didn't have any hangovers. Didn't know what I didn't know. I didn't have no serious problems. Just start doing crazy things and foolish things, having a good time, and start doing some strange things. As a matter of fact, I studied engineering in college. I was there on a partial basketball scholarship. My drinking got in the way of that. When I graduated from college, I also had a teaching certificate. I had a lot of mathematics courses, so I don't know. I look back at it, and I guess I was seeking glory. Instead of going in the engineering profession, I coached high school basketball. I went to coaching high school basketball when I was 20 years of age, when I got out of school. I had kids in my classes that were some of them older than I was. That's the truth at that time. And in a period of time, I fell upstairs in the coaching profession, had a lot of success in one school. I was 2 years, and then I went to a larger school, a lot of success. And as I look back now, I can see a pattern. It's all hindsight as my drinking began to develop and how it came about. And in the beginning, it was just weekend drinking, you know, having a good time, parties we call them, knockdown and drag outs are what they were. And sometimes I'd show back up on Monday, and sometimes I wouldn't get back to Tuesday. And, you know, you don't teach school in that kind of fashion. People begin to ask questions. And then it got to the problem that the point that I found that there was some relief in me, I began to associate it with school board members that drank. And usually I had a place to go about every night to do some social drinking, I guess. I don't know. And I look back and I can see a pattern, as I said earlier, but it got worse and worse and worse. And finally, it got to the point I was letting go of a lot of my responsibilities after about 3 years. My fifth year. And they began to talk to me. His principal talked to me about my problem. And, you know, I resented it, denied it. And you know, the alcoholic, you know, I says we alcoholism, you know, is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Well, the alcoholic is cunning, baffling, and powerful also. And so the alcoholic begins to get people off his back and, you know, divert their attention. And so I met a girl I'd known about 2 weeks, and we decided to get married. And I got their attention all right, and this was a mistake from the very beginning. I look back at it today, I know it was a mistake. And so this life began with this young lady that I remember promising that when school started in September, I wouldn't drink anymore. And lo and behold, when September came, I found out something I didn't know anything about. As I know today, the compulsion that we speak of had taken over in my life, and once I started, I couldn't stop. And my good mother, I had a mother that loved me to death, if you know what I mean. And I thank God for the fact my mother lived to see me sober 32 years. And that's another story, but my mother... at that time, did everything she could for me, and so I got a leave of absence. They call it nervous breakdown, and I went off to some of these, with no such thing as treatment centers then. They call them drying out places. I went to some of those places where you taper off. I don't know if any of you ever taper off. I enjoyed tapering off. Just get loose, you know, and keep sipping and taper off. And I just loved the hell out of tapering off. Never was successful, but I enjoyed it, and just keep on doing it. And I went to about four or five places to taper off, you know, and I'd come back in worse shape than when I went. And then I went to some places up there, four or five places up and down the East Coast, and finally I had some relief there, not the word sobriety, but I didn't drink for a period of time, and I remember promising this girl again that I wouldn't drink anymore, and finally she had enough, she left. And I began to get in problem with my job, a lot of problems. And the main problem was a girl basketball team. Somebody asked me to tell that. hell, I wouldn't tell this for years, but you got to understand something. I'd been coaching then about 5 years, and I'd gotten to the point I'd go to ball games. I was drinking vodka, you know. It leaves you breathless. And it wasn't the fact I was drunk or anything. I was, you know, just loose and going with the flow. You know what I mean. I was really right. And what happened, the fellow was coaching girls basketball, had to go into service, and I had to take him over in the middle of the year. And I was going to these ball games about half-sized up with this vodka. And the first night I had these girls... at a ball game. We got in the huddle just before the game, and you know how you give them a pep talk and hit them on the rear. And so I began to pat them, and the commotion began to develop in the background. It was the parents coming down out of the stands, and hell, I didn't know what was going on. You know, I was loose, and I didn't understand what the problem was, and I later found out what the problem was, and needless to say, the school board met the next day, and sure enough, that had a lot to do with me having to resign from that school. Out of those kids, a lot of them I got to know after I got sober in them. The strange thing about it, now I'm jumping ahead a little bit, after I'd been sober 5 years, that school board came to see me and asked me to come back and coach at that high school, and they'd find out what had happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous and how sick I was. But anyway, girls' basketball teams get you in trouble if you pat them on the rear, I'll tell you that. And what happened is I had to resign, and then in my home state of North Carolina, you just keep moving east. And I kept moving east, and finally you get to where you can't go nowhere else, and that's what happened to me. And I went to another school, they hired me, and they were desperate. It was a rock bottom of schools, really. And of course, my purpose of being there was to lift them out of the rock bottom, you know what I mean. And I'd gotten to the point then, I was living in a city that was not close. I mean, it was a rural consolidated high school, and I was having to drive about 15 miles to go to the school. And I don't want to stand up here and give you a drunk a log night, but the only way I can describe my drinking at that time, I got to the point I had to get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and start drinking to stop shakes, because I knew what was going to happen, and the shakes were there. So I could get on my clothes, you know, take a shower and shave, get clothes, and go to the schoolhouse. And invariably, I knew what was going to happen at 12, the shakes would come back. And I'd have some hit in the gym, or automobile, where I'd take a few shots, stop the shakes, pray for 3 o'clock, get in the automobile, drive back to town, and go to the beer joints, then go home, get stoned to the ears. His wife had left, I was just living by myself. And this went on for 6.5 months, and then one day at school, a man just walked up to me and says, "You're through. We don't need you anymore." And I look back at that, you know, I think by this time I had crossed that invisible line that we speak of. Ever what it is. And I didn't know anything about my alcoholism at that time. And to me, I had gotten to the point that I'd take one drink and I could no longer guarantee you my behavior. And to me, that's what an alcoholic is. I had experienced blackouts before, but never no prolonged blackout. And I left school that day. I don't know where I went for a period of 2.5 weeks. Woke up in jail for the first time in my life in this city where I was living. And a man began to talk to me when I came to through a cell door, and he later found out he was the county health doctor. And he said, "Son," says, "we're going to send you to a place," says, "your mother has come down here and straightened out all this mess." Now, mother had done this several times. She's come down here and straightened out all this mess, and we're going to send you to a place where they can cure you. Well, in my own mind, I thought I was going to one of them places where I could taper off again, you know. Drink, I didn't think I had a problem with drinking. I really didn't. I didn't think I had it. And this is a thing that I don't even understand even today. And I didn't understand it then, and I don't understand it today after working with a lot of alcoholics, being in AA for a number of years. And that's this. And that's the inability of the alcoholic to see himself as he really is in his worst moments. And this is the thing that probably just about destroyed you if you're an alcoholic. It just about destroyed me. But I could not see myself as I really was. Oh, there were times I used to take a glance and look at myself. Usually when I was down and out and had to bargain with somebody to get something. But you know something? As I began to get my health back, the liar in me would revive again, and I'd become that same person again as I'd get my health back. So I thought I was going to one of them places again, but that ain't the way I went. In my home state, the insane asylum is called Dix Hill. I went to Dix Hill for the cure. I've always said I too found my thrill on Dix Hill. That's where I went for the cure. That's where I went for the cure. And I was right at 27 years of age at that time. And I remember a lot. I never want to forget my first trip to Dix Hill as long as I draw a sober breath. I never want to forget it. The first few days, they put me in what they call the inebriate ward. Somebody was talking about it. I didn't know what it meant really at that time, but it sounded pretty good. And I adjusted that environment too. The people there, that they chased squirrels most of the time. And they'd run up and down the walls and under the chairs. And so, you know, when you're in Rome, you do as the Romans. I started chasing squirrels myself. Chased squirrels and never caught one, but come close a couple of times. Then one day they left me. There's been a few days I was in the inebriate ward, and they carried me over to another building where they put me in what they call Skid Row, which was where they kept all the men alcoholics, as I later found out. And And they put me down in the basement in what they call Skid Row. It was a padded cell. And they took my clothes away from me and locked me up and let me have my running fits. And that's how I got sober in Dix Hill the first time. And I had my running fits. And days later, they gave my clothes back to me, and then I was allowed to do the only thing I could do for the next 30-some-odd days. And that was walk up and down a day in and day out, up and down a corridor, wondering what in the world I was doing there. Because there was nobody there my age. The men were a lot older. And one night, the group of elderly men were playing poker. They were using matchsticks for chips. And they began to relate the reason they were there. And I can see that man's face tonight just as close, that's 30-some years ago, just as plain as it was that night. And one man said, "I'm here because my wife wanted to get rid of me." And I identified with that. Mama wanted to get rid of me. And my mama had done everything she knew how to do. And she'd spent a lot of money on me. And then this face spoke up and said, "I'm here because I'm an alcoholic." And right then was the comparison of comparing my drinking with my father. And this was the thing that was plaguing me until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, probably after I'd been sober a year. I compared my drinking with my father's drinking. And as the truth is known, he was a much better man than I ever hoped to be drinking. He lost a family. He never got kicked out of his profession. He never had to be put in jail. He never had to serve time. I had to do all those things. Because I did not have the ability to see myself as I really was. I had to be beat down to my knees before I could see myself. And the day came that I had to leave Dix Hill. I had nowhere to go because everything I'd accumulated since I'd finished school, I'd lost. Been through a wife and no children, thank God. Automobiles, a home, the whole works. I'd lost it all. And what do you do? You go home to mama. That's all you can do. And I did go home to mama, and she let me in again. And I don't know, I look back now, and I remember a lot of it. And I want you to understand something. I don't know a thing about drugs, but the good family doctor, always worried about my nerves, gave me some tablets to take. Now, I don't know a thing about drugs. I know a great deal about tablets now, and those tablets did the trick. I took my tablets, and I was running around with a crowd at night that was drinking, boys I'd been in school with and girls and, you know, partying, and they would drink, and I'd take my medicine. And now you're talking about being loose. I was loose then, and I'd just take my pills, you know, as they were prescribed in the beginning, and the thing that I remember most, the only way I can describe taking those tablets is one way. In driving an automobile, you come to a stoplight, you know, it's red, green, yellow. There's one up there that said, "Go ahead, Dave, it's all right. Just go ahead." You know, just go ahead. It's, you know, it's yours. The whole world is yours. And just loose. That's the only way, you know, loose as a goose, as the old boy said. About 9 weeks, I was on these nerve pills, and one night they passed a jug, and I decided I'd have a drink. And I took a drink, and then I found out, as we know it, the compulsion. And it was just a matter of 2 days later that I went back to the place I said I'd never go again as long as I live, which was Dix Hill. I went back to Dix Hill 5 times in 6 months. On account of one fact, I'd become an alcoholic, although I didn't know it. I'd take one drink, and I could no longer guarantee my behavior. The last time I went back to Dix Hill, they put me in the nut part of the bug house instead of the drying out part. And there is a distinct difference. This is when I found out about being tied down in the bed in a straitjacket. And how you live better electrically, I found out about that, too. You know, old Pelham Green, from down at Fort Payne, dead and gone. I don't know how many of you ever heard him talk or remember him, but old Pelham used to say, "I always felt better after I had one of them things." You damn right you'll feel better after you had one. But I look back, and it seems like a dream sometimes, because in that nut ward, they were nuts, and I was with them. And somebody was asking me about the biscuits today. Do you like biscuits? I say yes, in a reserved tone. You'd sit at the table with these people and you'd say, pass something. And they didn't know what pass meant. It means slung it or throw it. And you'd get a biscuit in your face, gravy, a bowl of gravy. It didn't make no difference. I've been reluctant to eat biscuits ever since then, but a strange thing began to happen, and it's a word that we have, and we call it an AA word. We hear it more in Alcoholics Anonymous than we do ever, a coincidence. Coincidences began to happen in my life then, even when I was in Dix Hill. I really believe that this power we speak of, that we find about after we get sober, whether we want to know it or not, I believe it was working in our life before we ever found it was there, or before we ever let him in our life. And I really believe that the power was working in my life when I was in Dix Hill at that time, because some coincidences began to happen. And what happened was I was taken out of that nut ward and put over there with the rest of rummies. And now you've got to understand something else. I'd been there so much, it more or less made me an honorary attendant. I was allowed to work in the kitchen. And some of y'all do a pretty good job, I notice, in serving food too. And brings back a lot of memories. And I was allowed to go get the mail and things like that. And one day, going to get the mail, two other fellows and I ourselves decided we'd just leave. And now, I don't want to sound dramatic, but we escaped. We ran like hell, too. And I go by that place a lot in there in Raleigh, and it's a 10-foot fence, three strands of barbed wire on top, both ways. I don't know how we got over it, but we come over that day, and that night we went downtown Raleigh in a hotel. The old hotel is gone now, but sitting there drinking a little and watching TV, and the news came on, and here it comes, three insane inmates over at Dix Hill just escaped. And we were standing there, well, I wonder who the hell they are. And And finally it dawned on us who we were, and one cried, one laughed, and the other one was sobbing, and it was a kind of dramatic playing there. And sure enough, we survived the night, but we decided we'd better split because it threw us out the next morning. And then we were our separate ways, and what happened is through a friend of the family that saw me on the streets in Raleigh, put me on a bus to send me back to my hometown. I was raised down in northeastern North Carolina, a place called Roanoke Rapids, close to the Virginia border. And this man put me on a bus to send me back home. And I got back to my hometown, went to my mother's home again. My mother, unbeknownst to me, I broke in the house and stayed there a couple of days until they brought her. She'd been in Richmond with a nervous breakdown. And unbeknownst to me, and of course they came home and brought her and found me upstairs, drunk again. And they let me get a little bit sober, and then the next day they got together. I don't know if you know who they are or not, but and they are those people that get in one room, usually the den, and put you in the next room, crack the door, and begin to talk about how much they love you, but what they got to do. And sure enough, they at that time were my two sisters, which were young, and I, and my mother, and a friend of the family was like a father to me. And one of them came in and began to talk to me and says, you're killing mother. We want you to leave this part of the country. We don't want you around here anymore. You're killing them with what you're doing. And we want to give you some money and we want you to leave this part and not come back. And there's nothing in the world that a practicing alcoholic likes any better than to get a little green on his hip. I began to agree with him. I thought it was a good idea. It was a wad. And it was enough to go to the West Coast and live comfortably for a period of time. And I told him I would leave that part of the country. And I did leave that afternoon, went 4 miles to a neighboring town. That's as far as I got. And pulled into an old hotel and had a lot of friends there for a long time until the money gave out. And 4 or 5 months later, the money gave out. And then I began to do the thing that I'd done before. If I needed money, my mother took care of me in the beginning. I went over to my hometown one morning and bought an outboard motor. Didn't have a boat, but I bought a motor and write a big check and get some change and pick up a motor later. And that afternoon or the next day or two, they called my mother to tell her that my motor was ready. And She, it was a friend of the family that I did this to, and as a matter of fact, he caused me a lot of trouble later on, but she began to put two and two together, and sure enough, that afternoon, John Law was there at that hotel room to get me out of there and carry me back to my hometown and put me in jail. I lived three blocks from the city jail in Roanoke Rapids, and every night for a period of 12 days and nights, everybody they put in that tank was out the next morning except me. And I didn't know what they were doing with me. And I began to raise hell down there one night, and I said, I want to talk to my attorney. Finally got to jail down there. And I said, I want to talk to my attorney. He says, who is your attorney? I told him who it was. Talk to him all you want to. He's the next cell block. And sure enough, he was. And, well, he couldn't do me no good that night. And now, maybe this is coincidence, too. That man later on came into Alcoholics Anonymous and found sobriety. He died sober, and he was a member of a state legislator at a later date. He, too, found the program. Maybe that was a coincidence. But he sure couldn't help me that night. And then one day they carried me upstairs, and I had to stand trial in the court of law for something I didn't know I'd done on a previous drunk. And you got to understand something. My sister was a city clerk in that building, and my mother's next-door neighbor was a city solicitor. And they didn't seem to know who the hell I was. And I mean, they just poof, right on through and carried me in a, locked me up again, carried me down the road a little bit further the next day. And I had to stand trial again for something I didn't know I'd done on a previous drunk. And as I said, you keep moving east in my great state and you get out there where you can't go no further. And that's what happened to me. And I've always been ashamed of this. I'm still ashamed of it, that I was put on a chain gang. And now my mother could have paid it out, but she had enough of it. And I was put on a chain gang down in the Great Dismal Swamps of eastern North Carolina. Worked harder than I ever worked in my life. And I say this with anybody that here tonight, I want you to understand something. You don't have to do the things I did to get to Alcoholics Anonymous and find sobriety. I was just one of these people who had to be beat down before I could see myself as I really was. And I was lucky in a sense that I'd been there for a few weeks, and the man who was superintendent of this camp, he was a young man, and he let me cut his grass on Saturday afternoon and then let me have dinner with he and his wife, and they were a young couple. And I guess this is the man that planted the seed of AA, I don't know, because he was talking to me one night, and he said, Dave, said, maybe it's your drinking that's causing all the problem. And I said, no. No, I don't have any problem. My daddy was a drunk, but not me. And I don't have any. All this trouble I'd been in, Dix Hill and all that stuff. And I'd heard about AA and Dix Hill. I'd heard about AA and Dix Hill because I used to go to those meetings on Sunday afternoon once in a while and sit in the back of the room, raise hell when a guy would stand up talk in front talking, trying to bring a message to the people over there. I'd drink the coffee and eat the donuts and raise hell back and make fun of him. I'd been sober several years when I found out something very remarkable. Every Sunday afternoon when that man got through speaking, he left and went home. I stayed at Diggs Hill. That ought to have told me something. No, we don't think that way. But the day came that I had to leave that place. I didn't have anywhere to go again, and the shame was there, and I didn't think my family, nobody would have anything to do with me, and there was a stigma attached, I guess, but they do take you back to your hometown. That's what they did with me, and I went back to my mother's home again for help. And I went to the back door this time instead of the front door. I guess I was second class by then, and she began to talk to me. And you know, there's no love like a mother has for her son, and my mother loved me. I knew that, And they got together again that afternoon, and they let me sit on the back porch, and they got to arguing about me, and my sisters and my brother-in-law came over and got in it. And I ain't going to get on him anyway, but anyway, the end result, I heard Mama say that he's my boy and he stays here tonight whether you like it or not. And that's when I made a vow that I would, wasn't the word sobriety, I just wouldn't drink anymore for her. And I was able to do this for a period of time. My mother loved me and helped me get on my feet, and things got better. And then one day it was suggested maybe I should go to work. Now, it's been a while, and about 2 years. And I used to have fun when the tax people used to come by to see me. And I'd be out there cutting the grass. And that was where I was earning my smoking tobacco at that time. And the tax people would come see me and want to know where I was in say, 50, in the year 1956. Where were you? I said, in Dix Hill. And they look at me kind of funny. I said, go ask my mother. She'll tell you where I was. And they couldn't relate to the fact that, you know, I was in the Goonie Roost trying to avoid taxes, but I didn't have to pay any taxes there for a while. That's the only benefit I got out of the damn deal. But it was suggested maybe I should go to work, and sure enough, through an agency up in Virginia, I was interviewed for several jobs in three different states in a period of 1 week. And my good mother took me to these places, and then one afternoon we wound up in Roanoke, Virginia. And a man began to talk to me. It was on a Friday afternoon, if I recall it correctly, and he seemed impressed, and I was impressed, and then he says, I've got to have some references and get on the telephone because we got to do something real soon. And I gave him some references, and I told my mother, I said, we might as well go on back home right now. She said, no, let's wait. And sure enough, in about 15 minutes, he came back and began to talk to me again. And he said, now, I've got in touch with some people, but I understand that you had a problem with drinking at one time, but that you're cured now. Now, I'd been sober then, not sober, I'd been dry, about 4 months. And I said, yes, sir, I guess I am, you know, for myself. We want you to go to work. So I came back the following weekend to Roanoke to start in a new job and a new life in spite of where I'd been, what had happened to me, the places I'd been, and degradation that I'd been in, and embarrassment I'd brought my family, and I'd come from the right side of the tracks, you know, in the right side of town and all that crap, but I was on the wrong side there for a long, long time, let me tell you. And I had a new start in life, a new start, a bankroll, place to stay when I got back to Roanoke, and a job. An assistant basketball coach and teaching mathematics, at that time the largest high school in Southwest Virginia, Jefferson Senior High School. And on the way back to Roanoke, when I had to go back on the bus, I had a little layover in Richmond, so I decided I'd have one drink, but I bought 2 pints. You know how we do, and that was the beginning of my last drunk, the only drunk that I really like to talk about, because that's the drunk that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the drunk that got me here. And it lasted about 24 days, and what happened simply was... I lost the job after about, I guess it was 10 days, 10 working days. I got back to the morning drink after the fifth day. And the same problems began. I had to do the same thing. And in the middle of the way, this drunk, my mother got in touch with me on the telephone and gave me the greatest gift she's ever given me since the day I was born. And that's when she kicked me out of her life, and I knew she meant it. And she wished me well and kicked me out of her life. And I wound up on the streets a few days later after she kicked me out of the hotel on the bum. On Sunday morning, September 11th, 1957, I was in the back alley in downtown Roanoke in what they call the market, trying to get a drink of liquor down, and the thought occurred to me that I was going to die in that back alley. I thought I was going to die right there. And I don't know, it seemed like to me, as I recall it, I think my moment of truth finally came, that I was dying from what I was doing. I was dying from what I was doing. And by God, when I knew what I was doing, I thought I was a leper. I thought I was the only person on God's green earth like me. I really did. And I prayed out to God I knew nothing about. Nothing about. And I didn't take the drink, and so help me. The only man that knew me in that city on the first, well, two men that knew me on a first name basis, the superintendent of city schools found me that Sunday morning. He'd been looking for me for several days. He didn't know anything about drunks, alcoholism, AA, or anything. He just wanted to help a human being. And he'd talked to my mother, and he knew she wasn't going to help. And he just happened to find me, and he'd been looking for me. And that man that afternoon got me out of that back alley and carried me to his home in the right section of town, and he got in touch with a teacher that knew a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that afternoon they carried me to a 12-step clubhouse in downtown Roanoke called the Easy Does It Club. And that was the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, September 11th, 1957. And I never want to forget that day because it got to the point on that last drunk, you know, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired of the high cost of low living. By God, that's what it is. I hurt all over. My hair hurt. My toenails hurt. Just want to do something different. And they didn't know what to do. And I'd gotten to the point I couldn't find oblivion anymore. I couldn't black out anymore. And I wasn't the fact that I was so drunk. I was just rum-dumb. I couldn't find the relief that I'd gotten from booze before. And these two men, the superintendent and principal, carried me up those steps, helped me get up the steps. Those darn steps. It seemed like it was 100 of them, that second floor building. And I don't know, I walked in that room and it seemed like to me to kind of look me over. We say we don't look them over. By God, you looked me over when I got here. And these two gentlemen began to talk to some members over here, and an old gentleman in the right-hand corner waved to me, and I wobbled over to him, and he put his arm around my shoulder. And I've never got behind on a podium. I don't mention this old man. His name was Old Man John. And Old Man John said to me, he says, son, says, all you got to do is listen to these people and do what they tell you to do, and you never have to be alone again. You never have to be alone again. Just do what they tell you. And what he was really telling me, as I know it today, he was reading me the first few lines of chapter 5 that Frank read a while ago. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That's what Old Man John was telling me. And let me tell you about Old Man John. He come to AA when he was 76 years of age. And he died at 82 with 6 continuous years of sobriety. And he's the man that rang my bell. He's the man that rang my bell, and I was able to identify. And I thank God for the fact I've been able to close the door behind me, and I've been here ever since. And so after Old Man John got to talking to me, they began to talk to me, and I began to shake a little. I said something about a drink. I said, no, we don't do it that way. Then I said something about some tablets, and I thought I'd started a revolution, really. No tablets. And they said, drink the coffee. And I started drinking the coffee. Now, before I go any further, I want to say this. This is no reflection of who's making the coffee this weekend, but I've always contend, and I still contend, that there are a hell of a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous making coffee. They ain't got no business doing it. And that was one of those days. It was that ropey stuff. It just hung. And they said drinking. I thought it was a requirement. So I drank the damn coffee the whole afternoon. And I got sick from it, from drinking so much coffee. And they carried me to my first meeting that night. And I don't know what went on. I remember sitting on my hands and wanting to go out the window. I remember that. But the payoff came when the meeting was over. And I don't know how it was for you, but I know how it was for me. When the meeting was over, strangers walked up to me, complete strangers. And they didn't ask me where I came from or what I had or they didn't ask me if I had any insurance. They didn't ask me a damn thing. They said this, we love you, we understand, and you're going to be all right. And they had the arm around my shoulder when they were talking to me that way. We love you and we understand you're going to be all right. And I really believe, as I look back at my sobriety, particularly my first year, I really believe I was loved sober. Because I didn't have nothing going for me when I got here. You had to love me sober. And that's what I think happened to me. And sure enough, when that meeting was over, it was proved to me I didn't have to be alone anymore. And I'll tell you how I got sober. That night, three men got me a room at the YMCA and stayed with me all night long talking to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, about the program. And they took, they didn't nurse me. They took turns sitting on top of me because I began to shake and jerk a little. And they said, now, if you get too bad, we're going to get a doctor for you. And they stayed with me all night long talking to me. And the sun finally come up, and one of the men, he's dead now. Said, Dave said, you've been so many hours without a drink. And this is the first time I ever heard the expression related to one day at a time. And he said, that's what we do in AA. We just try it one day at a time. And maybe you can make it today. And so help me God, I know what my thought was that morning, my first day in AA. I began to believe, and that's when I came to start believing right that morning, because I knew one thing. That if I made it that day, I had to be around them to do it. I had to be around them to do it. And as I stand here tonight before you with several years of sobriety, I know another simple fact. I still got to be around you to do it. I still got to be around you to do it to make that day. And I don't ever want to forget it. And so that morning I met my first sponsor, who I spoke of earlier in about sobriety thing, and the man asked me a lot of questions. And all of them were negative answers I gave him, and he said, well, it seemed to me that you're not doing so hot, and I wasn't doing so hot. And he got me a room to stay. I stayed in a boarding house with five other men, where we broke bread at the same table and got sober together, and I learned wonderful things from those other five men. Out of those five men, two of us are sober today, and three of them went back to drinking. Two of them are dead, one of them still drinking. And now, well, there's three dead. And all of them went back to drinking. And I owe much to those people. And I rocked along, got sober, and then I met my present wife, Sue. A few of you in here know her. And this was a coincidence, maybe. This was a gift, really, my wife. My wife has never seen me take a drink, never seen me drunk, but she's been through more hell than my first wife, because she's seen me try to grow up. And I'm still trying to grow up in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank God for her. And I don't know, I'd been sober for a while, and that group, and that was a powerful group. I learned a lot from them. I'd been sober about 9 months, I guess, and they finally let me talk. And someone was asking me about this weekend, and one of the fellows in the boarding house got drunk, and the fellows brought him to the meeting. And, you know, I had a hell of a talk prepared to give him, but the thought occurred to me, well, I better talk at him. And they propped him up in the back seat, you know, and he didn't know what was going on. And I started to talk on how not to slip. Never heard of one, but I started one. And I'd been talking about 5 minutes. I heard somebody say, sit down. And when you're stark raving sober, you don't sit down when they tell you to. And he got louder, and I wouldn't sit down, so he come to the podium and said, I said, sit down. It was my sponsors. And he was leading me down the aisle, back to that back row. That's where all the old timers sat. They call it Humility Row. And of course, I always sat with them, and you understand that. And as I was walking down that aisle, you know, people's aisles are kind of big. And the thought occurred to me, well, I got it too much power for him tonight, and he don't want me to overdo it. That's all it is. Now, you can begin to think what kind of thinking I was going through at that time, because it was about that time I was growing in sobriety, stark raving sober, knew a lot of things, and hanging around some people in AA that were not exactly working the AA program. It was a powerful group. They had an inventory room at that group. They'd call you in and sit you down and take the inventory, whether you liked it or not. Just call you in and say, sit down, we want to talk to you. And that's the way it was, and if you couldn't stand it, you left. And they solved a lot. I've always said I've learned much more with people with less education than now. The fellow that solved my employment problem was a man with a third grade education. He was a sign painter named Red. And one night they called me in an inventory room. The old timer sat me down, and they began to talk to me about my employment problem. I didn't have a job. And they began to discuss this and that, and I was just sitting there. And then Red spoke up, and he says, Dave, it seems to me that if you studied engineering in college, that's what you ought to be doing in life. Well, hell, nobody ever explained to me that way before. And sure enough, it made sense. And so through Red's help and my wife, Sue, I wasn't married to her then, they took me over to the Virginia Highway Department, over to Salem, Virginia, which is right at Roanoke, and I was interviewed for a job. Told the man the whole truth about what I was trying to do in AA and everything. And he was willing to help me. This was the middle of December in 57. I'd just been sober for just 3.5 months, I guess, something like that. And he hired me and said, we want you to go to work for us. And with your background, your education, of course, I didn't have no background, but I had an education. And you know, I was scared to death. I was scared to death. And he said, when can you go to work? And I said, it'll be about the 1st of February. I got a lot of business to do. And he said, well, fine. You come over here the 1st of February, and we want you to go to work. Went on back out the car, and Red and Sue were sitting there. How'd it go? Fine. You get, yep, got the job. When do you go to work? Told them what happened. They took my ass right back in there. And I've been working ever since till I retired 2 years ago. Went to work that day, and that's how it was for me. You know, I had just take them shots. God, I don't even know what time. After about a year and a half sobriety, I got to a point in my sobriety that I began to, like I said, you know a lot, and I began to hang around some people that were telling me to take what you need and throw the rest away. And I began to think like those people, and I'd gotten to the point that, you know, I'd go several miles to make a talk, but I couldn't go 1 mile to listen. And when you get like that, you're in tough shape. And one night they called me into that inventory room, the old timers of my sponsor, and set me down. And Sue got to the point she didn't want to be around me. And they began to talk to me, and the end result was that they told me that I had to get honest with myself and start working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which were the 12 steps. And I'd been sober a year and a half, and I resented it very much. And I got mad, and got ready to stomp out of the room, go back to the boarding house. And as I was getting ready to go out the door, my sponsor spoke up and says, "I want to ask you one question before you leave." And he says, "When was the last time you thanked God for a day of sobriety?" And God, that made me mad, and I left. And I went back to the boarding house and shut myself up in my room, and the thought to take a drink never crossed my mind. But I wanted to do something to him. You know, I wanted to do something. And so I sat down and wrote a written resignation to Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I was in this composition, about halfway, I began to hear his voice. When was the last time you think? It began to be an echo. And I'm here tonight to tell you that I was forced to my knees for the first time in my adult life, that I began to pray to a God again I didn't know anything about. God to me at that time, after a year of sobriety, a year and a half of sobriety and alcoholism, God to me was a question mark in the sky. Maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe yes, maybe no. But as a result of a juvenile prayer, I was able to go into a bathroom and look in a mirror at myself for the first time in my adult life, and I knew what I really was, that I was just a speck on this universe, that I'll die and soon be forgotten, and if I wanted sobriety, the only way I had to go was through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so the next night I went back to AA. I rejoined Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've rejoined every year that I get a chip on my sobriety date. I just start all over. I just rejoin. And I became a member of the clique. Now, if you want to know who the clique is, you get to the meeting sometime, see who does the work, and stay late and see who does the cleanup. I began to do those things. And I got involved in those 12 steps and did what they told me to do. And along in 59, it came to the point that in order for me to marry Sue, I had to move back to North Carolina to get a divorce. And my sponsor made arrangements for a man in Raleigh to take me over, and some of you knew him, a man named Tom Burrell. He's dead and gone. Now, Tom was one of the first 100 members of New York City, who later came south and worked in Atlanta at one time and moved to Raleigh, Maryland, later in Raleigh, and Tom sponsored me. And this man was one of these people. When I moved to Raleigh, you know, I'd ask people questions, let them know how smart I was. And Tom said, "Read the book, and then we'll talk." And he's the man that ran the big book down my throat. He really did. And he got me interested in service. And he was the man that gave me a great lesson about standing behind one of these podiums. I'd been sober a few years, and I belonged to the old Hazebard group in Raleigh at that time. And I'd been going to a few of these retreats and conferences and conventions and just watch these jokers stand up and talk, and everybody clapped like hell when they got through and kissed them and hugged them and kind of appealed to me. I told him, I want to talk to him after the meeting. He said, "Well, we'll go." They had an inventory room, and I went in that room and sat down. And he made you sit down, and he stood up and talked down at you. And he said, "What's the problem?" And I said, "Tom, I think I'm a convention speaker." And well, I can't repeat what he said, but now, the end result of the conversation, a moratorium was put on my speaking for the next 3 years. That's the God's truth. I wasn't allowed to speak for 3 years, and I could go to discussion meetings and mouth off there, but not behind the podium and give an AA talk. And he said, "When you're ready, I'll let you know." And I didn't ever think I'd be ready again. I really didn't. And one day he called me and says, "Come over to the house and bring Sue with you." And I said, "Oh, hell, what have I done now?" You know how that goes. And we got over there, and they went in one room, Sue and Margaret and Tom and I in another room. And I sat down, and he stood up. And he said, "Dave, I want to tell you something." He says, You're going down to Columbia, South Carolina. You're going to talk at the state convention. You do this, you do this, and you do this. Before you go, there's something I want to tell you. They asked me to go first. I can't go, and you're going as a damn substitute. And don't you ever forget it as long as you live. And every time I get behind a podium, I know I'm a substitute. And that's the way it is with me, and I feel good about it. And Tom gave me much. He really did. I don't know. I look around the room tonight, and I see a lot of young people here. And maybe some of you are wondering about this thing. Maybe you're saying, well, is this thing for me? Is it the truth? Maybe you're like I was after a year and a half of sobriety. Maybe you got to get honest with yourself about what it's all about. And I had to get honest with myself after a year and a half sobriety. Because I heard a man many years ago, I don't know who it was or where it was, he said, when Jesus Christ walked the face of the earth in the body of a man, he didn't say, I'm a truthful man. He said, I am the truth. I believe it's from this source and this root we inherited this program called Alcoholics Anonymous, because I've seen enough in my time in AA not only to believe, but to know that there is a power behind this universe that stands ready to help you and I, if we're willing to help ourselves. If we're willing to help ourselves. I don't care where you come from, how broke you are, or what you got. If you have the willingness to help yourself, that man upstairs is going to help you. I believe it with all my heart. And in the beginning, you know, way back, you know, I used to call it the man upstairs. At night, I called it the God of my understanding. The God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. The God that I found through you by your love for me. God, the Father of all mankind. And I found it right here in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I look back at my sobriety and the things that have happened to me in the sobriety and the people that I know and the places I've been and you know, It's a miracle. I look around this room tonight, and I know there are a lot of miracles in here. And I'm a miracle. And I never want to forget from whence I came and how I got here. And it's because of this fact that when I first got sober, my mother wouldn't have anything to do with my early sobriety. My mother couldn't understand for years, for several years, why I could do it for a bunch of strangers, and I couldn't do it for her. And it took 9.5 years by my mother ever to accept me back in her life as her son. And they told me in the meetings and my sponsors and the people around me said, you just keep working this program and this will come to pass in time. You just do what you got to do. And God, I worked at it and I prayed over it and I did everything. And I'd go home on weekends and it would be a fight before it was over with. And my wife would stay there and talk to her. And I'd go up to an old-timer's house up the street and spend time with him. And I'd begin to wonder when it was going to happen. And God does work in mysterious ways. My mother found out about Alcoholics Anonymous through two old ladies that knew me when I was a little boy. Just what AA was. But what happened was I'd been sober about 9.5 years. And they'd asked me to come back to my hometown and talk at one of these AA meetings. I opened an AA meeting. And of course, in my hometown, hell, everybody'd come to hear that, you know. And everybody came, my mother. She wouldn't come. And these two old ladies knew me when I was a little boy. Lived down the street from my mother. They came, and I went on back to Raleigh that night, and about 9 o'clock the phone rang. It was my mother, and she was crying. She was crying. And I couldn't understand why. And lo and behold, what happened, my mother was asking me to forgive her for what she'd done to me in my early sobriety. Not understanding what alcoholics was all about. And what had happened, those two old ladies left that meeting and went to see my mother and sat down and talked to her all that afternoon and early part of the night, telling her about AA and me. And the only place anything like this happens, I think, is in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God for the fact she lived to see me sober 32 years. And it got to the point that she was a close friend of AA after that. Those fellas in my hometown, they wouldn't call me to come down. They'd call her, and she'd call me and said, I told them you'd come, so you better come. Oh, God, I thank God for that. And you know, I found out something about love and alcoholics I never knew before when my mother died. You got to understand something. I have two sisters, and they didn't quite understand my love for people in AA, they really didn't until my mother died. And I remember at the funeral home that night before they buried my mother, literally hundreds of people came to that funeral home out of respect for me and what my mother had done for me. And my sisters just couldn't believe I had that many friends. And I said, hell, y'all don't know nothing. Really and truly, they've been, my sisters and I, since my mother passed away, have been closer than we've ever been in our lives. And a few weeks ago, they called me one night, and we get together and go out to eat at the various cities close by, and we meet. And real funny thing happened. They called me and said, we want to talk to you after we get through eating, and we don't want them around us. Well, them are my wife and their husbands. And I didn't know what I thought was something involving, you know, some financial reasons or something, you know. And sure enough, we got together, and after we had the meal, and we went offside, and I said, what's the problem? Says, Dave says, these conventions you go to in AA and speak at, we would like to go with you someday. We would like to go with you someday to one of these things and meet your friends. Now, this is a long ways from where I was when they carried me down that road that day and I was on that chain gang and when I threw all those beer cans and bottles in the ditches and didn't know I was going to have to come back and pick them up. That's a long ways in that chain. And you know, the strange thing about it, I can't take credit for any of it. Is it a coincidence as we stand here tonight that I look around this room and see some friends that have been a part of my sobriety and Jim that I've known for years when I was just a kid in AA. I mean, we were kids in AA then, and we were talking this afternoon about the old timers were ahead of us, some people that some of you people will never know that had the experience to hear and know that gave us this program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes I get upset at some of the things I see in the program now. In some of the places I go, I have a lot, you know, I think there's a lot of dignity in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't be here if I didn't. And I just have a respect for the program more than I ever had right today. But I look around this room and think of all the people that have played a role in my life. And it is a coincidence we gather here tonight on this mountaintop. 62 of these things. Is it a coincidence? Well, if it is a coincidence, I define a coincidence as an act of God in the midst of time. The same God that has been doing for you and I that which we could not do for ourselves. God, the Father of all mankind. I've been sober for a few 24 hours, but in spite of this sobriety, I've come to know there's some certain things I have to do. And the first thing I have to do is I have to continue to have a monumental desire to stay sober. I have to work at it. And, you know, it happens sometime when that phone rings in the middle of the night, and some guy or gal wants some help, and I begin to think, you know, can they wait till after breakfast? Those three men that first night, they carried me to that YMCA. They didn't drop me off and say, we'll be back after breakfast. They didn't say we'd be at. I told you I was willing any length to go get this. You know, I was willing to go to any length to get this program, and I still have to do it. The second thing I have to do is I have to work these 12 steps. Now, if you're young in the program, like I was at one time, and I argued with everything that was in it, I can save you some time. The program is the 12 steps. It's just that simple. And you can hang around here and defy them all you want to. But if you want peaceful serenity and good sobriety, the 12 steps is what it's all about. And as a result of these 12 steps, I've come to know that it says in my book, in your book, that we are granted a daily reprieve, contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I happen to know that it is for the alcoholic, that my spiritual condition has much improved as long as I've been trying to work these 12 steps. I really believe that with all my heart. Third thing I have to do is I have to do a little sponsoring. I have to work with people. And you know, the idea of I've been blessed with sponsors. Some of the people in here have known my sponsors, Tom and Willard. I've had 5 sponsors in my sobriety. And 4 of them are dead and 1 of them is living now. And I had to get one that was less sobriety than me because nobody would sponsor me. Afraid they were going to die, I reckon. But anyway, each one of those men gave me something that I'll never forgotten. And I look back and I miss them because they gave me much. And sponsorship, that there's something to it. And like I've often said, you know, there's a lot of difference in if sponsorship is carrying somebody to a meeting and dropping them off, there are a hell of a lot of cab drivers in Montego are probably mighty good sponsors. It's a little bit more than that. It's being a part of that person's life. It's being a part of that person's life. And you know, I have to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because that's where it's at. That's where it's at. I really, but you know, like I said in the beginning, I believe my home group is the best in the world. I'm sure you do too. And it's the little people in the group. I just feel like anybody walks through that door has the right to receive the same thing that I received in my sobriety. And it's my job to see that they get it. And I really believe what we're really doing is surviving among individual egos when we sit down and share with one another, eyeball to eyeball. Eyeball and know what makes us, you know. In my group, they know what makes me talk. You know, I have to walk like a talk because they know who I am and what I'm about. And it's the little people. I often told a story about Vernon and Gertrude. Some of you have probably heard me tell that story. A couple that I sponsored, they've had trouble off and on, and Vernon is still not in the program, but he should have more sobriety than I. And Gertrude now has about 10 years sobriety now, starting all over. But in the early sobriety, back before they got drunk the last time, and if you work with somebody like these two, you will either go drunk yourself or stay sober, and I've been lucky. It's the little people and the simple things, and this is the example. One night, Christmas Eve, I'll never forget it, years ago, and we had a meeting on Christmas Eve on the 8th step. I chaired the meeting, and it was just a few of us there, and I had to carry them home because of the fact they didn't have a driver's license. And we got in the car, and we're going down the road. We've been on the 8th step, and Gertrude said to Vernon, said, Vernon, said, tell me something. When are you going to make some amends to me? Now, they'd been married 16 years. And Vernon turned around and said, well, hell, Gertrude, you're not even on my list. And 16. Now, these are the kind of people I got to be around. Things like this. The other thing I have to do, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, some days I have to just hang on and do the best I can. And you know what I'm talking about. And they told me, as I said earlier, you just hang on and do the best you can, this too will come to pass. And it's from this that I kind of feel like that yesterday is my experience and tomorrow is my hope. And today is going from one to the other and doing the best I can. And I really believe that as long as I can walk hand in hand with you down this happy road of destiny that we speak of in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I too will be allowed another day of sobriety if I can do these things. Now, I don't know when I started, but I'm going to sit down. And I've always made this little deal that when I sit down, because I wish it were my words, but they're not. And it's in the big book, and it sums up the whole thing better than anything that I could say. And I say it every time I close a talk because it means it's powerful. And it tells the whole story before you got here and when you, for me, before I got here and when I left and where I'm today. And it goes something like this. This great experience that released me from the bondage of hatred and replaced it with love is just another affirmation of the truth I know. I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything I need I get. And when I get what I need, I invariably find that it was just what I wanted all the time. Thank you very much.